Pete and I are with Sarah Foxy this week on the latest episode of Supercharged, the Change and Comms podcast. Sarah is the founder of Marcom's Mind, is an Enterprise Nation volunteer and a Run Talk Run leader. And it's clear that Sarah is a true well-being champion. Pete, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, good. This Run Talk Run thing must be of interest to you, as I know you've been a keen runner in the past.
Yeah, I used to volunteer with Good Gym. And so the idea with that was that you would run and then do some kind of volunteering, gardening, whatever. But then I moved abroad. So unfortunately, in Spain, that does not exist. So now I just have to run and that's it.
Sarah, hello. Welcome to the show. Get us started then. Why don't you just tell us a bit more about what you're up to? I've given you a bit of a lead in there, but maybe just expand a bit for us.
Sure. Thanks, Chris. That was a great intro. So, so recently I am now solely working on what was my side hustle for almost 5 years. So Marcom Minds is now a limited company. It was a social enterprise. So it was a sort of non-monetized, non-commercial enterprise as a side project that I started in 2019 after myself and a few other members of a project team experienced quite a severe burnout. And I had to take 4 weeks off work. And it kind of changed my perspective really on where I wanted my career to go. And what I wanted out of it. And as a result of like going through the employee assistance counselling and changing how I sort of communicated with my clients and the time zones I worked in, made me realise what I wanted to get out of work essentially, and also what I wanted to get out of how I communicated and worked with my teams. So I have left sort of creative agency life behind, and I'm very new as the kind of CEO, founder, whatever position they give me on HMRC, company director, I think, something like that. So it's all very new to me. I had a bookkeeper that lived in the village until 4 weeks ago, and now I have an actual accountant, and I have to take things a lot more seriously than I did before, because this essentially is going to pay my mortgage and pay for my dogs to still eat food. Eventually, I want it to become a B Corp, and that is a whole other layer of paperwork that I can't even fathom right now.
That is a good, I think, segue into the first question I wanted to ask, actually, which, one of my favourite B Corp companies, I think they're still B Corp, is Tony's Chocolate Only. I don't know if you've come across them, right?
Yeah, I love them.
So they are one of the types of company now, along with other companies like Patagonia, who are really trying to shift the focus away from profit-driven to people-focused. And I wondered if you could explain a bit to us how in an organization you can kind of drive that type of change to move people's mindsets away from being profit to purpose-focused.
Yeah, that's a great question, Pete. And actually, it's a shift in mindset by businesses that want to be defined by what they do and what they're about instead of being what the bottom line says and then them being successful or whatever, like seen in the commercial world. It's not post-capitalism because we're not there, but I almost feel like it's you need a social proof. You need like a blue. If you're going to start a new business in this economy to succeed, if you haven't got a name for yourself and you haven't got brand awareness and you haven't got communication channels set up, you basically have to be purpose driven to cut through. Because to make noise in the market when we're in a downturn, you need to basically be so present and have a really good personal brand on all your channels and talk about what you're passionate about, what you believe in, and work with partners that align with that. And if they happen to be charities that sponsor events with you, then that's always for like the greater good. And that's kind of how Marcom Minds came about, because I was doing some quite cool projects with what some of the biggest global brands in the world. And then I realized that actually once we've delivered as an agency, you then don't see what happens next. You just do the work and then you hope it goes well. But because we were just a design agency rather than creative execution, we didn't ever see that part of it. There was no full circle moment for anything that I've ever built. I would just know through someone's PA that an ad was being shown regionally at the Super Bowl. And I'd be like, well, that's really cool, but I don't get visibility of that. I won't find out what the view rate was or like how many people viewed it. Like, that's a privileged access. When you work with tech companies and financial services, which I predominantly have for my career, you don't see the end to end when you were representing an agency. And like, don't get me wrong, like it's taught me to be a much like more creative, like agile marketer, but I did really miss that full completion of like, right, this is a goal. And you have campaign goals, right? But you don't necessarily always see it comes to fruition in like true life. All of the institutions that kind of run this whole wheel of agency life were like, we're losing so many staff through the Great Resignation because they all want to go in-house and see the end-to-end. And I was like, well, that's exactly why I'm kind of disengaged by the industry as well. And so now I'm seeing a shift of agencies like the one I've just left becoming more of that partner agency, that you are the agency of record for that type of marketing and communications, whether that's internal sales, internal comms, external, everything to do with that area of the business. You have a partner because then it's less of a direct threat to the business bottom line because an agency can change or you can probably have terms of service that mean that it's something you can flex a retainer on, like have a minimum level and then expand it. So yeah, I think it's just the kind of three of the Venn diagram that I kind of see is like it's tech, communications, and then purpose. Like it's all together. Like the purpose is so, so important. And then in the middle bit is the profit, because if you do those three things well, I kind of feel like the profit will come. And it's like if you build the reputation of your brand and you build the relationships up, then revenue is a direct consequence of doing those things, rather than revenue being the initial driver.
If the product is the person, when the person moves, whether that's a contract or whether that's a role, then does what you delivered in the period before break away because it wasn't grounded to the purpose? It was only grounded to the individual's persona, if you like, because it's suddenly not about me. It's about the purpose behind the brand of which I've set up. Have I captured that correctly? It sounds like I have in my head, but...
Yeah, very, very well put, Chris, and I completely agree. I'm in the process of kind of setting that up now with an advisory council, and I've got a couple of non-execs coming on. And so my goal with it was never really to hire, as in like, I like managing teams, but the pressure of someone else wanting to pay their mortgage on my head, sort of my plan is to kind of write the next 6 months of newsletters for my assistant to kind of just tweak if things change. I want to be as proactive as I possibly can in this bit of August downtime so that then almost the communications and content calendar for the next 6 months is ready, bar any major changes to the business or our economy. So it's those sort of things that I think then you have more time to think about your purpose. And so I typically, and it helps that I've got two young dogs, if I start work at about 5:30, and I'm not a morning person, mornings, I detest them, but because they wake up anyway, and then I struggle to get back to sleep, I tend to work between like 5:30 and 10:30 and have brunch, go for a long dog walk, and then come back to it like in the evening.
How would you convince someone who is very, profit driven, but sees the value of money, right? Let's say, that maybe there are other things that we could think about.
I think as a society, as an adult working population in a capitalist democracy, our natural inclination is to think about, I need more money. Like money gives you freedom. Money gives you choice. Money is a door opener. Money is something that we, unless we're born into a very wealthy family, will always want more of. Like it's a commodity that is not finite. Like we are always going to want more. However, the mainstream media, having been part of the way that these things are communicated for the last 20 years, especially as big businesses going to market with huge IT systems and some of the biggest sort of players in the market, they basically want you to spend as much money as possible with them. That's their goal. But the brands that are more socially conscious that you see growing more organically are the Tonys of the world, the consumer product based companies that put their purpose and the community before profit. So there's an agency down in Exeter that has become a B Corp recently, and it has completely changed the type of clients they have. Before they were a B Corp, and they were very purpose driven before, and I've got a lot of time and respect for them, and they've done a phenomenal job building the business.
Which agency is it?
It's called Organic. I think it's all capitals. The guys there are fantastic. Guys and girls are there, and just like, I don't know how many employees they've got now, but the culture they've created, They're in Exeter, just doing their own thing and doing it very well. And they get people working with them now that want to travel down to Exeter and go and see them. Like, I've worked with agencies that have been down in the Southwest that typically people outsource work to for a long time, including at Oxford, where we used to get some of our communications outsourced there. And they're fantastic agencies, but they never meet any of their clients. But what they've created there is so special in that you see them all the time having client away days, and like the way they treat their staff is night and day from how 90% of people that have worked for an agency have been felt. Because one of the agency groups that I worked for, and I think it's actually still on the parent group website now, their strap line is "Our purpose is profit." And there was
so what do they do differently day to day?
So I think that it's the shift from a capitalist structure to a purpose-driven structure. So everything they do is value-based. So I know that how some of the agencies that are going for B Corp status operate are working, because I work as an advisor on some of them, around like the values and the pillars. It's very much like an internal communications matrix where you've got a pillar and then an overarching message, like a messaging house. But the overarching messaging might be to be the most socially conscious agency in the UK, for example. And if anyone has got that, that's a pure coincidence. Well, I just made that up. But they might then have the people, the culture, the finance, and then the operations as their four pillars. Like, the finance and operations is going to pay the salaries, but the other two are going to make people want to work with you and for you.
Don't you find, though, those when I've been in environments where we've had that type of thing, it's really difficult to get that away from being lip service and to actually align to what my individual vision of my purpose of being in an organisation might be?
Yeah, I think that's the danger, is that a lot of people run businesses that are very profit-driven and don't actually believe in the value. So if the CEO or the founder or the managing director doesn't believe in the values, if there's no one present living those values, it will be lip service. Like, nobody will listen, because they'll be like, oh, it's just linked to like a 50 quid Amazon voucher every month and I've never won it, so why would I care? Like, I've worked at so many places that have had monthly employee recognition awards, and then it's such a nightmare to get hold of the voucher code from HR that they don't even bother. Like, and it's just the case where so many people think we're going to solve well-being by getting an app. An app is like a facilitator to access well-being. If you don't tell people what perks they've got, what benefits they've got, how to access them, what the codes are, no one's going to use it. Like, you could get Perkbox or Hecker or whatever you want to do that employee loyalty. If you don't remind people about how to use it, no one will use it. It's like if you have a staff handbook on your drive, but you don't link to it from your internal intranet, no one's going to read it. I think it's about facilitating access and making sure those values are not just thought about once a month for employee engagement purposes, but actually acted upon in every commercial or non-commercial decision you make. Because then that's where you really start to have the sweet spot of business change. And people start saying, I've never worked with an agency like this, or I've never worked in a team like this, and it's so nice that I never want to go and do anything different.
I do get the point, though, actually, and I think this is a big thing about changing comms, is that whilst there's so many things we do and we have to do, because that's the process or the methodology that an organisation has picked and we follow it and we apply the principles, where some of that real extra added value comes from is almost that concierge service of reminding people about those purposes and the tools and the facilities that are available to people. Because I mostly work in large programs. I have done for a long time. It's just the way things have ended up. And you go into these different places and the programs will typically follow a similar path, and they'll have their ups and downs and their peaks and their troughs, but they will always have times where things are tough, usually building up to a delivery period. And the value I've often found from being involved in that, from that change perspective, is to remind and show people what else is going on at the time, because you just kind of need to normalize the change a little bit and help them understand that, you know, everyone goes through this. This is not just exclusive to you at this period of time. It is quite normal. And because it's that normal, we have all these other things available to you that may just help take the edge off some of the stressful points. And that point of saying, you have a handbook, it's on the drive, no one knows it's there. I actually think that's the same with a lot of the wellbeing services that a lot of organizations offer. They spend vast sums of money on these resources, and they just assume people know they're there and they're going to go to them. But actually, the real art in some of this stuff is actually bringing the well-being champion or lead or whoever that is from HR into the program and actually making them part of the team. Because then you're normalizing it. You don't feel like I have to go off and find it or I have to go to this person to do this. Actually, if they're there in the same way that you want some comms doing or the same way that you want to arrange an event or you need to do your ad car surveys and all that good stuff, that the well-being person is part of your structure. And it's not uncommon for them to be there and to be speaking, you're actually normalizing the feelings to some extent, and they're more likely to go in and have those conversations before they actually probably really, really, really need them. And I think that's an advantage of having well-being in mind, which is what I probably was leading to earlier when setting up your change functions.
When setting up any transformation in your business, really, is because I've seen businesses go through huge changes, like you're working at Oxford University, getting a new finance system. Like, there was 5,000 users and they all had different needs, and I think we had about 25 different persona matrices or something wild. And so you're trying to appease the features and functionality to all of those people, but also make a community group of users that are early supporters of it, that are going to spread the message and be advocates for you, and also then reassure the people on the ground that once it actually fully switched over, that they are going to be okay, and that there's a present member of the program that supports their college or their department or their aspect of what they do in their lab that is, they need some procurement invoices paid and they don't know how to do it. Like, and so I think that what I've learned throughout my whole career, and probably what ties it all together really, is that you have to understand the person that you're talking to and what their needs are. And I think that's the real power in change communications, is that you can distill something down without patronizing somebody to make them feel validated and that they are seen and represented by whatever change you're bringing in. I feel like employers have kind of missed the boat with a lot of the well-being stuff if they're very well established, because they just, not in an arrogant way, I'm not sure what the right word is, but sort of a self-assuming way that people will just stay because they always have and they want to work for that brand. But actually, there's a lot of emerging brands like Organic and Tony's and Lucky Saint and lots of others that are doing great things, that they want to work for a purpose-driven organization. And the next generation especially so, like my nephew's about to go into secondary school, and I say to him all the time, like, what are your thoughts about what you want to go into? And he's just like, I just want to help people. And money is not a driver for him. Like, it's a consequence of helping people.
I saw some research recently. It was actually presented at an all-staff, like, away day type thing we were doing. But because it was talking about student recruitment, it was talking about how generationally, that roughly people born in the 80s expect a culture of leader tells me what to do, I will do that and do it to the best of my ability. And then, but the point was that across the generations, that now the kids in school expect to work much more collaboratively. And whether that's in like the changes we're starting to see towards agile teams and self-organizing teams and so on, I'm not sure. So what you're saying is backed up by research, though, and you see that coming through. We see it when we're coming through with the students that are coming into university now, is that they're much less accepting of being told what to do, which is quite strange to lecturers and people in the position to tell them what to do. And they want to be much more like co-creation. That's the word I'm looking for. And so I think that will have a big impact. But the spread across the workplace, obviously, is also getting bigger. So people are expected to work for longer.
I think the future dynamic of organisations will be much more driven by what the outward perception of them is. If the person is not referred by word of mouth or doesn't know someone that already works there, which is increasingly typical. And that's where internal recruiters, I think, have done very well. If they do a good, decent recruitment process, that they know that they put a box on their application form that says, do you know anybody that currently works there? And like, then they can then chat to them informally off the record before they interview them. And I think that's hugely important, because the majority of the contract work that I do is off referral, like for previous clients or who people I've worked with before. And that, I think, is a very sustainable way to grow. Like, I've never spent a penny on advertising, and I never really intend to, because I'm hoping that my network will fuel that rather than spending money on essentially faceless advertising for the brand. Like, I want the brand to become its own a brand in its own right that carries itself, and people recognize it from the symbols that are associated with it. And so I think that's where businesses will go to, and that will attract potentially the younger generation. My generation is a millennial, and then the next generation and the generation after that. But then there will be aging business models, like legacy technology, legacy payment platforms, to a certain extent, legacy education platforms. And because certain people want to still work how they worked 10 years ago. They want to still go and sit in a lecture hall every week, and they like the structure and routine of that. So that won't go away, I don't think. But the blend of learning online, offline, hybrid, the way information is communicated will be much more around the user rather than the company. So if the company knows that somebody in their team has got ADHD and they're very open about it, and they know that they don't respond very well to written content because they find it too overwhelming, that they create a video for that training for anyone else that was also neurodivergent, is suddenly making them feel seen, making them feel like they're in an inclusive environment, and the way they're communicated to is based on how they want to work. And as soon as organizations make that shift, I think that that's where the true power of retention is, because you're going to be loyal to a brand that represents your otherness or what you need from your employer. And that is going far beyond like fruit in the office and a well-being app. Like, this is truly on the ground. This is what we're about, rather than the old style of the people at the top make all the money, and the people at the bottom slowly trickle down, and actually they don't really see, it's a faceless organization to them. If there's a 10,000 global staff and you never meet the founder, they're this elusive person that you never meet. And that was accepted for my parents' generation and for the most of my career. And now it's all about knowing your audience and knowing your customer, right?
Just as we kind of wrap up then, I think the interesting thing there is, I think that the way in which businesses have spawned over the past, well, forever, have been led by big business. So big business breeds big business. It was very difficult in days gone by for a small business to start up, grow and become big. There's films and there's books about it, right, when they exist. I think that's changed. I don't think that's an original thought, by the way, just to say that.
Premise, I think, Chris, of the book Shoe Dog, which is about Philip Knight that started Nike. And that is very much how he started, as a sort of maverick that was like, had this dream of being a competitor to Adidas. And now it's a film with Ben Affleck.
Well, I'll have a watch. Because anyone with a credit card can essentially go and set up a business and get their hands on some high-powered compute through the likes of AWS or Microsoft or any of these other providers, and suddenly generate pretty quickly a pretty big and powerful firm if they've got a unique idea. And my point being there is then that the culture for that organization as a startup doesn't have the history of all of those ways of working that you've described as being, you know, something that the modern generation and the future generations want or expect when they get into the workforce. So the influencing in that space is going to, I believe, will be a whole lot quicker than it has ever been before. And that, yeah, we'll still have the old way of doing things, but actually there'll be a lot more choice for, you know, the employer of the future that someone chooses to work on based on their own values, and to your point, to the way that you're setting up and running. I think that the choice becomes a lot more prevalent, because it's not going to be as difficult for a startup to get big. That's right. Pete, biscuit yes. Time.
We better wrap up, but before we do, what is your favourite biscuit and why?
Oh, that's a tough one. So I've got a lot of time for a dark chocolate hobnob, but it's quite heavy. It's quite a heavy one. So I would say day-to-day biscuit of choice, and my village shop's just started doing it, is the Bourbon. Like, I just think you can't go wrong. I love a Bourbon.
Do you know, I buy 4 packs a week for my boy. 4 packs a week. Yeah, and he's even got his favourite. He gets all of them when I get anywhere near him. And he's even got his favourites. Like, he says, make sure you get the Sainsbury's ones.
No, I'm not sure about that. It's been fascinating hearing about your personal journey and what you've got planned as well. And I'm looking forward to the global domination. Well, maybe that's not the right word, actually, given what we've been talking about.
Yeah, well, I take a few territories. I think Australia first, but yeah, we'll see how we get on.